We welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Yeah, what's up, Kimball?
Oh, my goodness. Well, big day. The Tom Brady news, certainly not a surprise. You have shared some thoughts about it on social media today, and I agree with you on most of them, including the fact that I don't think there's any way Tom Brady, and I hope he doesn't, do one of those one-day contracts to retire as a Patriot things.
What did you disagree with, Kimball? Let's fight.
I don't know that I disagreed with anything. Let's see. I did think it was odd that he didn't say anything about the Patriots fans, at least, but then he kind of did later on, because everything Brady does is calculated. So whatever it is, he's sending a message of some kind.
Yeah, I wouldn't have said anything about the last team. It's what, he's 9 days out from the end of his season?
Right.
So you're still, the season's still going on. This isn't, what was that program where, like, you sit there and they have, like, Rich Kimball, this is your third grade teacher.
Yes. Tom Brady, this is your life.
Right. It's not, this is your life. And he was in the moment, the final moment, although I have some thoughts on that, too, of his NFL career. There is a nowness to that. I would have thought it would have been so strange to, whoa, Kraft and Belichick and Adam Vinatieri and the snowball. It's not the time. Just that would have been so awkward to me. And I think the reason that we don't just accept this normal behavior is because we are ruled by perverse behavior that is social media. So
right.
I don't think it was a middle finger to Patriots fans. And you know what? Patriots fans, there's no bigger Patriots fan than I. Grow up. This is not your life. This is his life. These are all separate things. Find more meaningful attachments anyway, but like that you're spurned? Wouldn't you, like an 11-year-old girl? I mean, grow up. I just find that so, I hope, because I think he's going to regret this. I think that his wife told him, you're retiring. I think that's what happened. And I hope that he does find a way to challenge himself again, and maybe he tries to come back at 47, I'm thinking now, because with half of his life in front of him, maybe more, I think it's going to be tough for him.
It'd be interesting to see, because he has been such a competitive guy and so focused, and I think business will be his thing for the time being, because he's not going to be a broadcaster. That's not anything he wants to get tied down with. And I just don't know that you can ever find that same level of thrill and challenge watching the money roll in by hawking $300 TB12 football jerseys.
No, it's when you are the best at something, when you're great at something, you're the best there's ever been. If you told me that I couldn't create my art, I couldn't, even if I had like means and a life of comfort right now, which I don't, as we've discussed, but I wouldn't be able to keep living. If that was taken from me, if I had $1 trillion from making my art, I would be more determined to make the next great work of art that would blow people's minds. That's everything I am, and I think that's one of the difficult things for an athlete when you're a Gretzky or you're a Brady or a Jordan, that you don't have that anymore. And he didn't even reach his oft-stated goal of playing till 45. And I'm not sure that that was necessarily the plan, in that he could have gone beyond it. I think he was open to that. But I think he did have his heart set on 45. And to walk away when you're that good, when you've mastered the sport, that's what he's done. He has mastered his sport. How many people can you think of that have mastered their sport? Wayne Gretzky in the early and mid-80s, but mastering the sport where you're thinking it at a different level than everyone else doesn't mean you always win, because that's not just how it works. It doesn't rain every day. So it's interesting to me. But the Patriots fans, it's just, you just see these man children. Like, grow up, dude. You're not some like little kid. And even like little kids have more perspective than like these bro dudes.
Well, because I think there is that personal attachment that is, well, it's completely one way.
There shouldn't be.
You're right.
Any personal attachment. You should have a personal attachment to, this sounds strange, but you should have personal attachment to things that encapsulate who you are and help you better understand who you are. So whether that's a record or a film or nature or whatever it is. But this guy playing a children's game, this is, I knew people like after the Patriots lost the Super Bowl in 2007, like they were upset for a while. And it's just like, it's a game. And even if it wasn't like, this should not be, I think it speaks to how empty, really, just hollow, Tin Man lives that so many people are living. And I find this too, even with people that I know who've ostensibly gotten everything that they've wanted in life. And they didn't set out for that much, but they got it. And I just see them like miserable, creaking through their marriages and drinking and having getaways and being bored every day. And I think it's for that person that a Brady or whoever it is becomes this figure that you just, you glom onto in this unhealthy, parasitic way. And he was the best that I've ever seen. I think he put any sort of debate about that in the sport of football to sleep. But yeah, I'm sad. I'm sad because greatness is rare. And you know what, Kimball? Competence is rare. How many people out there in the world are good at their jobs? Less than 100, not very many. I'm not even talking greatness. And he put the time in, and he was competent, which is a big thing, and he was great. And I sort of think that when you are great, you keep extending it. You take it as far as you can. That's almost like your human duty. But also, it's his life. He gets to do what he wants.
Well said. No disagreement on anything there, but I rarely do because you always make a whole lot of sense. Colin Fleming with us here on Dan Turner. We've got a number of things to talk about this afternoon. The Brady thing was not on the agenda, but Colin's always flexible. He can pivot like that because he's Colin Fleming, damn it. But let's talk a little music here and start with Green Day, a great live set from back in 1992, close to the beginning for them. And this was, a little club, 924 Gilman Street in Berkeley, and that was a hoot to listen to. The harmonies are phenomenal, but I also enjoyed the onstage patter as well.
There is some great patter. Their early shows were large on great patter. And what's interesting about this show, too, is, I mean, it's just this like sort of all-time live rock and roll document. But did you notice when you're going through it, like you're looking at the tracks, it's like, first performance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Of all of these, well, now they're these Green Day chestnuts. But you're just going out that night and you're pounding back the beers, two-fisted Kimball style, and you're walking in on rock and roll and punk rock history. And it's funny because I can't think of a show by somebody that has that many songs that are getting their debut performance. So what that's going to mean is you haven't been doing anything for a while. You've just been rehearsing and writing songs. Now you're sort of coming out. But like, there's this Laz show. You know the Laz from Liverpool? And it's in 1987. And at the first ever performance of There She Goes, Lee Mavers just says, new song. And then like they kind of start. And so you're there like in view of this history, but Green Day is one after another. And I think when they came out and they were billed as this bubblegum punk and everything, their music has aged, in my view, so well. We're talking one of the classic bands, not classic rock, but this is some significant art. And I was listening in the last 2 days running stairs to 21st Century Breakdown and American Idiot going up and down the stairs, and you hear how they use the piano in 21st Century Breakdown, and you just hear the orchestral sort of Wagnerian Who-esque largeness of American Idiot. And it's like, wow, these guys really knew what they were doing. They had a plan all along.
And the vocals, everything is so good in this live set. I mean, yeah, you can make a case every bit as good as the studio versions for some of them.
Yeah, we talked about their BBC sessions, and the earliest of those from 1994. But really, you could just listen to this. You could study this. If this was put out as an official release, streaming on Amazon, and there was a CD of it and all that stuff, Spotify, you start making the case. Like, yeah, leads. You can do it. Jerry Lee Lewis, Star Club, all of that stuff. You can throw this in there, my man Sam Cooke. And it works. I mean, it's just a phenomenal thing. And again, Not to say that everyone out there is a lazy-ass plonker, although, no. This stuff is all very findable. You can go out and download it. You can find it on YouTube. You can record it from YouTube easily enough that even someone helpless with technology like myself can do that. But, yeah, heavily recommended.
Another great listen. And we know about the influence the blues had on the Stones. I don't know that you'll ever hear anything as bluesy from the Rolling Stones as them doing Muddy Waters.
Yeah, it's up there. I would say, I wrote a big feature about this once, that the Stones' ultimate blues is a song whose title I can't say in full on the radio, but we'll just call it CS Blues. You know what I'm talking about, do you?
No, indeed I do.
Yeah, because I picture you stripped to the waist at night, belting out that chorus upstairs, and your wife's like, oh, it's just that crazy, Richard. I feel like I have your domestic scene.
Seriously, are you watching me? Are you listening
yeah,
through
know,
Alexa?
Right?
What's going on here?
See, dog. He doesn't do the technology, but he's bugged my den. So this is the Stones in 1968, Still a Fool. Muddy Waters song came out in 1951, and it's unreleased. Again, another thing you can go out there and easily find. And the Stones unreleased stuff isn't quite as rich a vein as, let's say, the Beatles unreleased stuff, but there's some real goodies in there. So what's notable about this, I would say, among other things, is it's Brian Jones' last big moment with the band he helped start. He's going to have a sad and tragic ending not too long after this. But that is him playing slide guitar on this opus. It's like 12 minutes long, and we like to talk about volume sometimes, and this is a loud one. It's loud on its own, and it works well for playing loud. And it's a classic blues archetype of what we talked about before, two trains running, and that's sort of a trope you see in a lot of different blues songs, and Muddy Waters was using it within the Electrified context, but it's not like he came up with it on its own. It was floating in the blues-based air. So for an unreleased Rolling Stones song, though, this is one of the top places to go. And those whole Beggar's Banquet sessions are fascinating to me. There's some really good stuff in there. You have all the outtakes of Sympathy for the Devil that Godard was going to use, but this is the top of the Rolling Stones unreleased pile.
All right, from there, we go to a wonderful slice of television from the Dean Martin Show. And I remember watching this live. I have a strong memory of this as a kid. And even as a kid, I was aware that the Dean Martin Show was a sloppy mess that would just sometimes have moments that would amaze you. And this was one of them for me. Orson Welles doing Falstaff from the makeup chair, from sitting down. And while he's applying his makeup, explaining who Falstaff was, and then all of a sudden making this incredible transformation right before your eyes to Sir John.
I can see how someone seeing this would remember it, whether you were an adult or a kid or whatever you would have been, because how many things have there ever been like this on a television? And Falstaff is going to become Chimes at Midnight, and Wells cobbles it together from all of these different sources, Shakespearean sources. But he was looking back when he made that film, which I think is his best film, on an England that didn't exist anymore. The merry old England of Robin Hood and mead and ale houses. And I recently saw the film A Field in England, like that kind of England that John Clare lamented was being lost as well. Because he was sort of after the golden age of that merry old England. And Wells was hyper self-conscious about his makeup. He almost always used false noses in his performances where he was acting. And he just was someone who was self-conscious of, it's like he needed that layer of protection between his authentic self and an audience to allow him to go out and perform. So if you know Orson Welles really well, it's surprising that he did this. It's him like in this pretend like backstage setting, but he's out there in front of everyone, obviously. And he's applying his makeup and he's talking to you about some of the things that I'm talking to you about and just walking you through it. And as you said, he morphs into the character of Falstaff. And Falstaff, we have to understand, and I agree with Wells, Falstaff was Wells's idea of a truly great man. And that doesn't mean like this non-sinner type of guy, because Falstaff was chock full of vices. But he was someone of a large and generous heart who was a person for others. Mm. So no one else really thought that about Falstaff. You go through all the years of Shakespearean criticism. But Wells always maintained that he was a great man. And I think Wells saw a lot of himself, like he was trying to tout himself, but he saw a lot of himself in Falstaff.
Well, it's unbelievable to watch it. And I've seen it, I don't know, seven or eight times at least through the years. And every time I'm just, it's breathtaking because you're watching this happen and then magic right before your eyes. So check it out. It's on YouTube.
Well, Orson, with the whole idea of a Merry Old England, but think about this. What a different world that was. We began this conversation by talking about like Twitter idiocy. It's just so far afield from what was being done, at least at certain times. And there's plenty of trash at the time, but it just elevates us all, something like that.
Right. You would never see that on television today.
I think part of the reason, now I can't be defeatist about this, because I have to look forward to things of that nature and things even surpassing that nature. So I can't be defeatist about it. But I think one of the reasons you don't see it is because there isn't someone with that talent. There isn't a visionary who's put in a position to take their talent as far as it can go. We've talked about this. I think sports is the only meritocracy left in America. But people are so acquiescent. They're so, I'll just do, Who strives? I don't think anyone strives. And I think if people did strive and they were inspired to strive, I think you'd see more things like this. I don't mean necessarily like, oh, it has to be Shakespeare on TV. But we all know, like, what's that line? Like, pornography, I know when I see it. We all know a striver when we see one.
Well, that leads us into what's next, which wasn't going to be next, but it seems like a much better segue. And that's into one of your recent tips of the day that you post on the blog. And this was about the idea of being proud of yourself. And but I've read this several times, and I've thought about it a lot. And I think we can agree on one thing, that there's too much misplaced pride in the world these days.
Yeah, so I'm doing a thing on the blog now, which is what you said. It's the tip of the day. I'm not doing it every day. Don't get greedy. And but I'm doing enough of them. And so I think for people out there, it's one thing to talk about this, but I think the way it's written is really the way to go. Like, you need to see how this is written, because what is it? It's like Pascal with a pensée. It's like Montaigne. It's something of that nature. And I had encountered someone saying, I encounter a lot of people saying it. They're proud of themselves. And I do things, frankly, that no one who has ever lived can do, whether it's what I create, how much I create, how much I endure, how I keep going in the life I'm in. I've never said, and if someone wants to be like, who's this guy going on? Go read the work, go to the website, go read the blog, and the scales will be removed from your eyes. But I've never thought, really, that I'm proud of myself. And it's not because I'm like some puritanical hard ass. I just don't think in terms of that. And I think the more likely you are to think in those terms, the less you're actually going to have to be proud of. And I've done things and endured things and gone through things, and I've not only have I not lost my core humanity, I've found a way to grow that humanity into something better than what I was before. But I never thought, I'm proud of myself. And I've done this alone. I've done this without friends. I've done this without love. I've simply challenged myself to answer to the standards that I think I should meet. And I think that's the difference, because when you meet those standards, you've done what you expected yourself to do. Should you be proud of yourself for meeting your expectations? I don't think so. It doesn't mean that you're not self-loving and that you don't care about yourself and that you don't try to foster that same strength and vision and love in other people. It's very different than being proud of yourself.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. First of all, are you saying that people would have to weather something horrific to have any reason to be proud?
No, but I would say somewhat unrelated to that, but a little related, that weathering things, like for instance, I was thinking about you today, this Flores thing, the Miami thing, and you must have an entirely different definition of discrimination now, knowing me like you have over these years. Like, can you imagine how something like that makes me feel? Like, that's like rubbish, what's happened to
us. Oh, see, that's not rubbish at all. That's institutional racism that's gone on for years, and you can't deny that. Look at the record.
I don't know that that's institutional racism with him. With him, it's more that he wasn't willing to violate the rules to talk to Watson. I think that was the larger issue. I think he upheld a certain moral code. And for people who want to talk racism, the most discriminated against person in this world right now is an athletic-looking white male genius in Boston. I live this. You see this. If someone wants to be in denial, that's their business. But I've presented a legal case. I mean, that's sort of where it's almost heading on that blog in millions of words over these years. This is real. It's not in my head. It's the New Yorker and in Harper's and all of these places, the Atlantic, all writing each other, all banding together to blackball somebody who can do simply things that they can't do. That's why it's happening. So when I see someone else sort of like having a problem, which is nowhere near in terms of the same scope, I think, what would someone be doing if they were going through what I'm going through?
Yeah, but Colin, the point is this, though. Everybody's suffering is relative, and your pain
There is no relativism. Relativism says that there are no absolutes. That's an absolute. So right away, relativism cancels itself out.
But if he's being denied and others are being denied the opportunity to do that thing they love, that they're passionate about, that they're great at, and it's largely because of their skin color, that's pretty bad for them. It's as bad for them as it could be.
I don't know that it's because of his skin color. It can be so many things. That couldn't have happened to a white person? Of course it could have.
But when you look at the NFL, when you look at the hypocrisy of the Rooney Rule, and then what does the NFL do? What do these rich white owners do? They go out and hire a bunch of the same sad sacks that have been floating around the league, and they're always mediocre white guys.
They're not. Well, yeah, sure. But if you're just making it NFL-centric, I think a lot of that has to do with people who have circulated through the system for a long time. And you're seeing people in other walks of life, certainly in publishing, people are given book deals solely based upon the fact that they're black or that they're trans. And
absolutely.
Why don't you ask Bruce Pratt how he feels about this? Because you know what? Bruce Pratt, and I'm not telling you something that he hasn't told you, I'm sure. Bruce Pratt has no chance of significant publication. You know that, right? Has nothing to do with what he writes. It's because he's a 70-year-old white guy. He has no chance at all.
Oh, absolutely. Like, and I'm not saying it. We know it's happening to you. It's happening to others, and it is discrimination. It is a form of racism. No question about that. But that doesn't mean it's not happening to other people as well.
Racism?
Yeah.
There are all kinds. It's
like you're not the only victim of discrimination in the world.
No, I'm saying that I'm in a situation of discrimination that is unique to me. I am being discriminated against because of genius. That's what's happening here. It's not because of, now it doesn't help that I'm white and there is that discrimination as well. But this is happening once in the history of publishing, the history of the written word, like it's happening right now with me. You cannot find someone else who's published six of the things I've published who doesn't have a major book deal, let alone the 2,500 that I've published. That's real. That's what's happening. There is not a historical precedent, and anyone who thinks there is, it's just acting out of their own incredulity because there must be. So, no, there is nothing like this. There's nothing close to anything there has been like this. And that's why the blog exists. But to answer your original question, no, I'm not saying you have to endure something. But I don't think people have an idea what it means to endure and carry on and to be ostracized and blackballed. Because when it does happen to an entire group, you can at least turn to the person next to you and say, you know what? I'm a Jew. You're a Jew. This sucks. Let's go out and make our own business. And a black person can say that. Who's the genius I turn to and we're going to band together? So when it's thousands and thousands and thousands of people against one, I don't think it's remotely the same. I think someone else would be dead trying to live like this within days.
Let me ask you this then. Can one be proud but not satisfied?
I'm not like trying to be biblical and saying pride comes before a fall and all of that. I'm more talking about purpose and how standards are lower and more lax for people than they should be. And what does it even mean to be proud of yourself? You pat yourself on the back, and that to me is fairly narcissistic to go out there. And the people who say this the most often, at least say it, are people who are proud because they voted or they got a shot. I don't think these are like significant things in life. I don't think they're what we're tasked with.
So when, and we're in agreement on a lot of fundamental things, which is this: social media is an absolute cesspool. Are we seeing the things we see, the narcissism and more, because people are actually proud of relatively insignificant accomplishments, or because they have no sense of pride or self-worth, and so they have to manufacture these things, these random moments, to feel better about themselves?
People are idiots who do nothing with their lives, and they don't know what purpose is. And when you add up those three things, going to CVS and getting something on sale and saving 30 cents is something you become proud of. There are no standards. There are no intelligence. And I know you're supposed to say like, well, everyone's unique and special in their own way. They're not. They're morons. And people are accepting of that. A lot of times, as I've said before, intelligence is a choice. Like all of the raccoons are born more or less the same way. I'm sure there's like some mega genius raccoon out there who would get all the crayfish and it was really easy for him. But for the most part, you're a raccoon. And it's the same thing if you're a human. So it's, what are you going to go out and learn? I crack wise and say, hey, don't be a lazy plonker. Go look this stuff up. If you did, you would be a completely different person. If you did enough of it, if it added up, you mentioned to me once that you say to students, look up a word you don't know or write it down and look it up. People did that. It adds up. You become a smart person. Watch Orson Welles films. You become a smart person. Go read the books. Go to the blog. All that stuff. You become a smarter person. So that's a choice. And people don't make that choice. They stare at what is put in front of their face. And that can be a lot of different things, a lot of different narratives, a lot of lazy narratives. And we discriminate against kinds of discrimination. Because believe me, Kimball, I would love to be a black person right now. If you gave me no talent and I was a person of color, I would be ruling this publishing industry. I'm going to ultimately anyway, but that it comes down to things like that is a far, far, far bigger problem to me.
Why do people set their expectations for themselves so low?
I think because they're enabled by the people around them. I'm sure there's some people out there right now who'll be like, oh, he's like being insulting and all these different things. But I don't think I am. I'm just saying, have higher standards for yourself. Have purpose. But when you're around everyone, like, for instance, we're talking about publishing. Do you understand one of the reasons, like, okay, I've written 12 short stories this year. I've written a book. It's February 1st. I've written, like, however many blogs. I've written 6 op-eds. I've written however many essays. That's a career for people. You think people in my industry want to see someone doing that? And I send you the stories. You don't say much about any of those, but I assume you read them, and I assume you know the level that they're on. You think someone else out there who just wants to write maybe 100 words a week is going to enjoy knowing that I'm doing that? Or are they going to be pissed? So who are they going to surround themselves with? People like themselves are like, oh, wow, you wrote 100 words this month. That's really good. And then it's just this soft slide into oblivion. But that's what people want. Why do you think when I post these brilliant, fascinating things on Twitter, how many were there today? 4? Anyone, go look at them. I challenge you. See anything smarter than that? Funnier? Better written? No? No one hits the like button because it's intelligent. Who do they hit the like button for? The moron. That's what people like because it's non-threatening to them.
Well, yeah, but that's not how Twitter works either. Twitter works through interaction, and people want to interact with somebody they look up to, things of that sort. So people don't respond to a whole lot of stuff on Twitter that's you know, maybe not as brilliant as yours, but moderately entertaining at the least, but
well,
they want interaction.
Here's the thing, though. So you're saying these examples to the wrong person who has answers and has data. So when I'm in the Wall Street Journal, and it has the highest circulation of any newspaper in the country, millions, when they put that up on their Twitter feed, and they have things from people that are not widely published, no one knows of, have done nothing, whose do you think always gets the lowest reaction, Kimball? You think, you know me well enough to know that I know my numbers. It's always me. New York Times, Rolling Stone, it doesn't matter. It's because people look at it and they think, I don't have a mind like that. I couldn't do that. It's not on their level. I'm not saying the thing that they think. I'm saying the thing that they can agree with that they never would have come up on their own, and I'm saying it better than they say anything in their life to anyone. And people don't like that, and that's my biggest problem to overcome right now. But I have the USA Today, second highest circulation in the newspaper. Go look at their Twitter. You'll see, huh, this one is far lower than everything else we've ever put up. It's Fleming, every single time.
All right, and I understand that from look, we know what's happening to you from the publishing world, but in terms
this
of...
This isn't the publishing world, though. That's the world. There are two different things. And you might find this surprising. Well, I mean, I've said it many times. My larger problem is actually the world rather than the publishing world. Because if I can get the world, I can go back to the publishing world and lay whatever terms out there that I want. But people want to go into a bar. A friend of mine uses the example. They don't want to see 1963 Bob Dylan with a guitar in the corner when they're there on their date. They want to see some schlub so they can say to their lady friend, like, yeah, I'll play you some tunes when we get back home. I got the old guitar. That's what people like. It's comforting. Comfort. Comfort is everything. And comfort is usually sloth.
So how do you ever reach an audience that doesn't want that challenge?
Well, Kimball, right now, as you know, I call it faith. I'm the best artist who's ever lived. I think if I keep going and if I keep creating, I keep staying strong, I keep not just rolling over when someone says things to me that I know are false, that I can empirically prove are false, that eventually the greatest artist who's ever lived is going to prevail. That's what I think. And that's the faith I have. Someone can knock that. Someone can say, well, that's not feasible, but it is to me.
That's good stuff. Colin, thank you, my friend. I appreciate it.
All right. That's good.
Colin Fleming every week on Downtown.